Mormon Mental Health Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations are tax deductible and go directly to the costs associated with podcast production. Donations may also go towards research, material development, and counseling costs for those who can't afford them. The goals of this podcast include education, advocacy, and the promotion of health and general well-being for Mormons and their families. To support the podcast and its efforts, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. Thank you for listening. Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I have the honor of interviewing Dr. Holly Hancock. She is a therapist, a psychotherapist that works in Salt Lake City, and she also happens to be a member of our recently founded association, the Mormon Mental Health Association. And I am excited to have her here today to talk specifically about issues regarding the transgender population. I know that with Caitlyn Jenner's transition from being Bruce Jenner, that's been in the media a lot, and there's been a lot of just, I guess what I'd call media frenzy around that topic. There seems to be a lot of myths and misconceptions, and one of the goals of Mormon Mental Health Association is to present the Mormon public with accurate and evidence-based information that will be helpful to hopefully all involved. Both just the general population, ecclesiastical leadership, other Mormon mental health professionals, and, you know, family, friends of people who are maybe dealing with some of the subjects that we cover. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Hancock, and I'll be calling you Holly as we go, if that's okay with you.
Yes, please.
Okay. And I know that you volunteered as a test site counselor at the Utah AIDS Foundation back in the day when you were working on an undergraduate degree. And since then, I think you got your bachelor's in women's studies and a master's in mental health counseling and your doctorate in counseling psychology. So that's a very brief introduction. Could you please give us a little bit more about your background and how you come to do the work that you do?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. First of all, this is an honor, and I'm happy to share any information, albeit probably very little, with the community and with other professionals, but I'm thankful and appreciate you asking me on. So sometimes when I hear my bio read back to me, it's like, really, did I do all that stuff? And it's sometimes I don't feel like I'm old enough to have done all that stuff, but I really am.
Right.
So I guess, yeah, my first introduction into even just the LGBT community was I was in a class at the U in my women's studies program. We had what is called service learning. And in order to do service learning, you had to do community service. And I chose to reach out to the Utah AIDS Foundation. I was interested in being a community educator and also a test site counselor. And through that, I became really interested and thinking that I may want to go into social work or some sort of mental health field. But it took me a long time to get there. I worked in the legal field for maybe 5 to 7 years. I don't know. And I was concurrently working in the legal field as well as as working on graduate school and getting my degrees in counseling. And just knew that it was a fit, knew that this is what I had to do. And I think, like many counselors and mental health professionals, you feel like you're called to this work. This isn't for everyone. This isn't for the faint of heart. And I have felt very strongly that this is one of the things that I was meant to do. And I love my job. I have not had a sick day in a very long time, since opening my own practice. So, I really love it. In terms of continuing to work with the LGBT community, it goes without saying that it's a marginalized population. And one of the reasons why I wanted to be a community educator was just that, to educate the community at large in terms of getting them factual information and not wrong information or myths or mystery, anything that might be sensationalized in the media and has and is. So really, on a grassroots level sort of way, doing what I can to educate people about working with and what it means to be LGBT. Now, I do have to say that I myself am not in the LGBT community in terms of the fact that I am cisgender, which means that I identify with the gender that I was born as. I was born female and I identify as female. And so with that, I can only speak quite literally from a psychoeducational perspective, meaning that I haven't had these experiences firsthand. I have worked with dozens of people in my office and their experiences that way, but I don't want to offend anyone by saying, you know, this is what I've experienced. And if I do say that, it's that, please take it in the context of this is what I have experienced with patients in my office. So I don't want to offend by telling things as if it's first person, because that's certainly not the case.
Correct. And LGBT, just so that we're clear, refers to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. And today we'll be focusing mostly on transgender issues, which tends to, you know, I've been at many conferences where they, you know, they wish that the T was almost separate from the LGB, right? Because they're quite, they're definitely separate issues to educate yourself on. And yet they coincide in many, social justice issues and also in, I think, the lived experience that obviously orientation and, sexual orientation is separate from gender identity, but also is part of how we identify ourselves. So somebody who is transgender could also identify as either gay or straight or, you know, mm-hmm. things of that nature. So we'll get more into that as far as, but really I'm hoping helping people understand that transgender is really its own category that's very important to understand, as we try to, you know, be more accepting and loving and of people in our communities in that regard.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So having said that and given a little bit then of you do work with Mormon population, and I think you grew up Mormon yourself. Are you comfortable sharing a little bit of that, how you come to be a Mormon yourself?
Sure. I, like you said, was born and raised Mormon, active my whole life. And again, people could split hairs about what active means. I did serve a mission in Japan. I absolutely love Japan and have been back a few times since returning. And I would, just to be honest, have had various levels of activity throughout my life, different times of questioning and really questioning and seriously questioning. And those times really are brought about by issues very closely related to the LGBT population, particularly when the Prop 8, I don't know what you might call it, the issue, the case, the legislation was coming up in California. That gave me a real cause for pause and a real time of reflection and trying to figure out, is this what I think it is? And this does not sound like the church I was raised in, and had to do a lot of soul searching to get through that, if you will. So,
yeah. And so you still identify as Mormon and you're still actively involved in your congregation and things of that nature, it sounds like. And the only reason I say that, not that it's important necessarily for, the information that you give to be valid, because there's lots of great ex-Mormon therapists or current Mormon therapists, or, you know, that I don't want to parse out the specifics of that for everybody. But I do think it's important that people know that both of us are members of the church and we hold a great respect for the church and have a lot of, I guess, belief and commitment to what we'd call gospel, you know, principles. And so that we're coming at this topic from that perspective as well, that we're not trying to be offensive to church members or anything of that nature.
Absolutely not.
Okay, well, so let's get started then a little bit with what, you know, I met you and got to know you because you were giving a presentation called Trans 101 at last year's Sunstone Conference, which was excellent, by the way.
Thank you.
And so why don't we just start off with you kind of giving us some basic information about what it means to be transgender and some of the terms and, you know, things of that nature that you'd kind of consider 101 knowledge.
Perfect. Let me just say for the record that a lot of the information that I present in the Trans 101 presentation is largely from a book that I have grown to call my Purple Bible, because it is a great basic introductory book in terms of what gender identity is, what is attraction, what is sex, what is expression. And it's called The Gender Book. And this was a grassroots effort to really get good information out to the public on what it means to be anything regarding gender. And that goes, you know, all the way from 110% masculine to 110% feminine, if we're looking at that binary, and everything in between. So to me, the gender book, and you can go to their website, they have a ton of free literature, things that you can print, things that you can have teens and anyone else really take as discussion type materials. I have a genderqueer patient that is starting a new school, and we went through that website extensively looking for ways in which conversations can transition and Z can more comfortably be able to articulate what Z is. And again, great information. I'm going to probably massacre the website. I would maybe guess that it's thegenderbook.com or genderbook.org. Either way, I'm sure if you look it up, you'll find it.
And we'll make sure to link to that when I post this.
Okay, sure. That sounds great.
And since you just mentioned a new word that I think I just want to be very basic, can you explain what queer means?
Again, that is a term that is largely up for debate. And queer, as I might very simply describe it, might describe someone who doesn't feel that they necessarily know where they fall on the gender binary. They don't really fit on the masculine end. They don't really fit on the feminine end, but they fall somewhere in between. And perhaps maybe the case that they haven't really identified for themselves who they are in terms of gender identity doesn't make any sort of difference one way or the other if someone decides whether they're male or female or what have you. I talk a lot about clothing. And when you look at clothing, just in the general population, sitting anywhere in a restaurant, in an airport, on the train, wherever you are, yes, you can tell very certainly what gender someone is by the way they dress. But if you look in the middle, for example, right now I'm wearing jeans and a University of Utah, like three-quarter baseball type shirt. If you were looking at me from perhaps the shoulders down, very easily, that could be either gender. And where maybe the queer population is they just say, I am who I am, and I express how I want to express, and don't put me in a box and don't put me on a label. So I hope that's a little helpful in terms of what it means to be queer.
Right. Like more acknowledging that there's a spectrum, right? And
sure.
Also that's why a lot of times now you'll hear people say, instead of LGBT, you'll hear LGBTQ, or, and it's referring to that terminology.
Yes.
Okay. All right, go on. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no,
with the...
that's fine. Maybe remind me what the question
was.
Yeah,
no, just basic. You started off by talking about the gender book, which is a great place to start as far as understanding some of these terminologies.
Yes.
And I know that there's a great, I'll link to this as well, but it's called The Gingerbread Man. That kind of, again, is a nice visual that kind of talks about all the different terminology that can get confusing.
Yes.
So those will be definitely things that we link to. As far as just basic information then that you'd like to make sure that we cover when it comes to understanding transgender.
Sure. One of the things that might be helpful is just the concept of transgender itself. And a lot of people hear terms like transsexual and transvestite and cross-dressing, drag queen, drag king, all of those sort of things. And for simplification of discussion, one of the things that I appreciate that the gender book did was said, again, for the simplification of discussion, we're going to put all of those terms that I just mentioned and many more under this umbrella we call trans with an asterisk. And that asterisk does represent all of those different terms for those different types of individuals and how they identify and express themselves. So sometimes when you talk about a trans person, automatically people might get a picture in their mind of a drag queen or someone who cross-dresses. And those are two very distinct types of people in terms, again, of identity and expression. And again, clearly different from a transgender individual who, again, identifies and expresses in a different way. So
in other words, you can be a male cross-dresser and be very comfortable with your male identity. In other words, not be transgender. And you can be transgender and never cross-dress, right? So in other words, and some people, I think, when it comes to transgender identity, which is such, I think, a difficult thing. I mean, we really don't know necessarily. I mean, they say about 3% of the population might be, well, 1 to 3, if I'm remembering correct, might be affected by some sort of transgender spectrum issue. I think it's still very much something that many, many people don't have the language or knowledge of how to even talk about.
Right.
So my assumption would be that many people are living with transgender concerns and just not openly discussing them or have even mentioned them to anybody in their life. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. There was recently, this Sunday, as a matter of fact, John Oliver on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, which is an HBO special. If you can catch it, he has about a 16 or so minute segment on specific trans rights, trans issues, etc. And he gave the statistic of there's approximately 700,000 trans individuals in the United States, and that's about the population of Boston. And in his joking sort of way, he said, and everybody knows someone from Boston. So I think just pointing out that even though you may not know personally, chances are you probably do, and maybe you're not aware of that person being trans.
Right. So how did you personally come to know more about this issue or become involved in wanting to learn more about this issue? How did that come up for you in your professional career?
I have spent a lot of time with particularly LDS and LGBT patients and clients, and the demand and the need was becoming pretty significant with the trans populations, particularly with how do I transition if I want to stay active, and am I automatically going to be excommunicated? And those are kind of the spiritual and religious crossroads that people hit with regard to being trans and transgender, but also just from the very beginning, like, what do I do first? And where do I go first? And is this really happening to me? I mean, some people come in and they're still confused about what they might be experiencing. I'm sure that people have experienced that even with the LGB community, meaning that, you know, if I'm a member of the church, then I have to be heterosexual and I have to go on a mission and get married in a temple and have children and live happily ever after. And so there's a lot of probably general confusion among that spectrum, again, LGBT. And so you know, I've worked with people from the beginning of, well, am I? And exploring that with them, up and through surgical intervention for expression of identity. So really just out of need did I come to start working with this specific population.
So need meaning people that were your clients and having to, and then saying, oh my goodness, I better look into this and know more about this because I'm having clients walk in with these types of issues. Or as you became more known about this, you're getting more and more people referred to you.
A little bit of both. Like I kind of noticed an influx and a need that way. And then now, certainly as I've seen more people are calling, in terms of wanting to see someone who specializes or who has experience working with transgender patients.
Right. Okay. And, so let's talk a little bit about the transgender journey. So I know that with many of my transgender clients, it seems to be something that they started wondering about fairly early in their life. This doesn't seem to be an issue that all of a sudden pops up in your 30s or 40s. And I've even had several parents now that are calling me looking for help with, you know, a pretty young child who is presenting, you know, transgender, what do we want to call it? Just transgender issues or transgender,
presentation or markers or indication. I think any of that would be appropriate.
Yeah. So can you share a little bit about what the typical, I know that not every story is typical, but what might be the typical kind of developmental cycle or lifeline cycle for a person who does experience these issues?
I would say, and based on my experience, a vast majority of people, again, even in the LGB community, recognize fairly early that there is definitely something, and I don't want to say this in a negative way, but there is something different about the way they perceive themselves in relation to other people, whether that's being gay and having an attraction to men. Certainly, back in the day and when I grew up, I mean, I was still watching Happy Days with Mr. and Mrs. Cunningham sleeping in separate beds, let alone the thought of, you know, something like Will and Grace happening a few decades later and, you know, Jack and Will have a first kiss on, you know, national television. I mean, we're clearly at a different place now than we have been in the past.
Right.
So, like I said, I think people start identifying at a very young age. Now, the coming out piece, I think, is a process. I think certainly it's cultural. I think it's familial. And really how comfortable someone is with their surroundings to be who they are and want people to understand and recognize who they are authentically. Some children have the wonderful opportunity of having very affirming parents, and it's a little bit easier for them. And I would suggest that people take a look at Dr. Caitlin Ryan's work out of San Diego State University and her project called the Family Acceptance Project. She's got some great data in terms of what the likely outcomes are in terms of even mortality, if we're talking about just even life expectancy for the LGBT population, that depending on how affirming a family is can significantly decrease dangerous behavior and suicide. So I feel like I'm getting a little off topic in terms of like information.
No, that's fine. I totally agree. Her work is phenomenal. In fact, she's going to be our keynote speaker at the Mormon Mental Health Association this year, which I'm super excited about. And you will be presenting as well at our Mormon Mental Health Association. So I'm very excited for the conference coming up here in July 29th.
Yes.
And for those of you who can hear a baby in the background and might be annoyed by that audio, I just say this is Mormon women doing our work. So
that's right. This is true. I have the coos and oohs of a 5, almost 6 month old.
That's right.
So,
this
is how we do work.
Encourage everybody to up their tolerance level on the audio quality of our podcast.
Please and thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, I agree with you then that it seems to be pretty early on, even though they may not be talking about it till teens or even adulthood. And like we see, for example, with the example of Caitlyn Jenner, who grew up in a time where this really wasn't easily talked about, you know, she's coming out, you know, in, I believe her 50s or 60s, however old she is. And so it's something that obviously has had a lot of taboo behind it, and it's difficult to discuss openly when there's so much cultural controversy around something. And in Mormonism, obviously, gender is very important. We take gender very seriously. We see it as preordained. I really appreciated Elder Oaks saying something in one of the news media outlets, saying something along the lines of, there's still a lot of information we need to gather about transgender issues. And even though I'm not always aligned with some of the things they say about the LGB community, at least they seem to be taking pause and more willing to gather information on this particular topic. So that's encouraging, I think, to hear that.
Yes. Yes. I sometimes I feel like we get some mixed messages in terms of the information that we get out of Salt Lake in terms of the LGBT community. But from my opinion, I have seen tolerance, acceptance, and accurate information being disseminated from the Brethren more so than ever before. And it's happened rather quickly. And I don't know that we'll see a lot of change in terms of, I don't even know what I'm trying to say here, but the change will come because we've seen it come. I don't know how far it'll go, but certainly what we have seen in terms of the website, MormonsandGays.org, and other church-sponsored information, I think is a huge step forward in the right direction.
Correct. Yeah. And I will link to all of that as well. Yeah, and there seems to be some research that I've been aware of that the sooner transgender folks transition, the better they do. So in other words, there are many who would find it quite difficult to understand why pre-adolescent or adolescent children who are still minors are having things like hormone replacement therapies or things of that nature. When they see it still as a decision that is difficult to make as a child, maybe if that's one way to put it. And yet we understand that people who prior to, you know, adolescence, of course, is puberty, you know, and your gender becomes much more hormonally anyway, you know, I guess, you know, if you're biologically a male, you know, you're going to start growing hair. And if you're biologically a female, you're going to start growing breasts and things of that nature. And so if you don't identify with that gender, puberty can actually be quite traumatic. And for children and adolescents who've been assessed correctly and who go through correct hormonal replacement treatments, that can be quite beneficial for them from a psychological perspective. Is there something you want to speak to on that regard?
I would just agree that in terms of psychological and psychosocial outcomes with those individuals who are able to and have the support of parents and physicians in a community that will allow them to start with hormone blockers to decrease, minimize, and even stop depending on the age at which they begin hormone therapy, certainly have better outcomes, like I said, psychologically, emotionally, and even just their confidence and the way that they present to the world is probably, and again, this is just my opinion, but just those that I've seen, they know who they are. And there's very little question that as they grow through the adolescent and teen years, as they get into the later teen years, there's no question. And I love to see that confidence. in those individuals. And I'm thinking particularly of a couple of girls right now. There's a, what's her name? Jazzy. Natasha, have you seen her story?
The trans Mormon.
No, that's Emmy, who I was also going to talk about.
Okay.
I'm really bad with last names. Oprah Winfrey did a documentary series on a young woman named Jazzy, and her parents did intervene at a very young age and started with blockers. And Jazzy has recently been in the news again as one of the new spokesmodels for Clean and Clear skincare line. And she is the first transgender teen to do so. And so that's pretty significant there. And again, if you want to get more information on her story, Google Jazzy, and her last name starts with a J2, I'm pretty sure. But again, Oprah documentary series, and I'm pretty sure you can get all of it. It might have to be in segments, but I'm pretty sure you can get all of it via YouTube.
Okay. Okay. I'll look for that as well. Yeah. So, I mean, if you can just imagine, you know, and what I think is interesting, and maybe this is crossing on the offensive for some transgender folks, because I'm just trying to, again, put the Mormon paradigm on top of this picture, which is probably somewhat inappropriate. But from the Mormon paradigm, you know, if we're really going to have this belief that gender is, you know, preordained, I don't know that there's as much issue with the doctrine being controversial here, because for a young child to pretty consistently, you know, be telling you from ages 3 to, you know, 9 that they're not the gender they were born into, for me, fits the Mormon paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, you know, there's something there that's beyond the body. There's something there that's spiritual or psychological or emotional that they're tapping into that, you know, I don't know what your thoughts are about that without being too Mormon-y about it.
Let me see. I would have to say that with the LDS LGBT individuals that I've worked with that have really done their soul searching and really done their work in terms of resolving those conflicts with their, you know, their sexual development, their gender identity, and religious views and values, I've heard time and time again, and in very sincere and heartfelt experiences that are clearly very tender, very personal, that LGBT members of the church are receiving confirmation through their own personal prayer and pleadings with the divine, and have received that personal confirmation that they are as they are, and that the Lord, again, the divine, whichever we're referring to, did not make a mistake, and they are who they are, and they are loved.
Right.
And so I don't know if that kind of borders on Mormony, but I'm certainly not going to discount in any way, shape, or form someone's personal experience and their right to personal revelation. And I don't apologize for that.
Yes, no, and I agree. And I've had that as well in my practice. I think the only reason I bring that up is more to help those who are not in that lived experience and who have very little capacity to understand what that might be like.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes so easy to judge. And I'm just saying there might be some way to conceptualize it that, you know, that we can support people in their gender orientation or their gender identity,
mm-hmm,
by opening up our ability to think about our doctrine a little bit differently.
Right, right. Certainly, I mean, even members who have been excommunicated who are still devout members of the church have expressed again, time and time again, that their knowledge and confirmation of the truthfulness of the gospel, and again, that they are who they are and they are not a mistake.
Right. Yeah, that's beautiful. And it's interesting that we're both having similar experiences in that the testimony of the gospel, again, from a Mormon perspective, is oftentimes not altered by all of these other very complex and really hurtful issues, like becoming excommunicated because of your gender nonconformity, right? But yet the gospel testimony stays intact for many people, and they continue to attend and continue to worship. I know many who don't, and I totally understand that choice as well, because it can be so extremely hurtful to be rejected or feel like you're being tolerated, or, you know, not feel like you're being completely welcome into our community, or seen as other in some way or shape or other. Even when we try to be polite about it, there's no way to be polite and truly, or I guess tolerate and truly be accepting. I mean, those are two different kind of concepts. So
I agree. Tolerating is, never mind. I just agree. Absolutely.
Well, and people know when they're being tolerated. And, absolutely, you know, and I mean, it's a first good step. I'm not saying that's not, it's good to tolerate others, but I'm just saying you can't expect somebody to feel welcome and feel comfortable in a place where they're only tolerated.
Right. And one thing that I do in terms of educating people who may not have a lot of experience with the LGBT community, and certainly the trans community, because that brings up a whole different set of issues. But one of the things that I encourage people to do and educate people to do is, rather than tolerate, be curious. And what I mean by that is, if you put on your what's the word I'm looking for? Your curiosity cap, for lack of a better word, and are genuinely interested in someone's experience of the LGBT experience, get curious and ask them about their experiences and what questions can they answer for you. And again, if you're curious, then there's less of a chance, in my opinion, of being judgmental.
Yeah, I like that. Because I think in the current, you know, in our current culture, especially with as much airtime as there has been given to religious freedom issues, I think a lot of cisgender straight members feel this sense of defensiveness because things are moving in directions that they're not comfortable with. And therefore, and that defensiveness is there in this idea of, well, but I have a right to my opinion. You know, I have a right to my beliefs or to my opinion. And although I think there's truth to that, that gets in the way of the curiosity that you're discussing right now, that this idea of what might it be like to be in somebody else's shoes? You know, what might it be like to live a very different reality than I get to live every day? You know, what would it be like to be in a church where these things are said over the pulpit and I'm sitting there not fitting that box, you know? And so those, I think, are really interesting conundrums we're currently finding ourselves in as we're trying to have these discussions, often done not well, as we can see on Facebook and things of that nature, where we allow our own defensiveness and reactivity to get in the way, right, of I think what we all want, which is better understanding and better living of our gospel, right? So that's interesting. So I like that. I like the curious thing. Okay, well, let's get into some, I think some of the kind of top myths that I would say go around this issue. I mean, one of the things, and this is maybe more clinical, but the DSM, which is a diagnostic statistic manual, which most mental health disorders and issues are listed in that book, has had a history of a lot of things in the LGBT community, right? So, I mean, back in the 70s, for example, homosexuality was considered a disorder, a mental health disorder, and that was done away with in the 70s. There are some, the DSM-5 just came out a year or two ago, and there were some changes in the language of that. It used to be called gender identity disorder, and now I think it's been renamed gender dysphoria. Am I correct in that?
Yes, that's correct.
And so can you speak a little bit about, some people would say, well, if it's in the DSM, that obviously means that there's a problem and it's an illness or an issue that needs to be cured or fixed. because it's in the DSM.
Right, right. And I don't want to equate any sort of mental illness or any sort of physical illness to gender dysphoria as being something wrong with someone. Because I am a private practitioner and I don't bill insurance, I have the freedom to treat someone for gender dysphoria. And when you're looking at, like, again, this becomes a whole healthcare issue, and I don't want to get into that, but it's difficult to diagnose someone with gender dysphoria and then have services for physical well-being, mental health issues covered by insurance. And again, those things are progressing and moving forward, but there are a lot of tertiary issues to gender dysphoria, and a lot of that can be generalized anxiety, depression, sometimes even more severe forms of depression. And when you look at mental illness, and again, depression and anxiety being among those, there's still so much of a stigma. And to throw gender dysphoria into the mix with depression and anxiety and other mental illnesses, you know, gender dysphoria just becomes even more heightened in terms of stigma and misunderstanding. I think a lot of people, just with general diagnoses from a mental health care professional, struggle, because then there is something truly wrong with them. If I have to see a therapist because neurochemically I have an imbalance in serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine, there is something horribly wrong with me. And I think destigmatizing mental illness in general helps. With gender dysphoria, I just think that there just needs to be, again, more and more information out there. And I don't know if that's answering the question. And again, I hope I haven't offended anyone.
Yeah, well, I think the point we're trying to make is that it's not an illness. And just because it is in the DSM doesn't make it an illness. I think the reasons why it's in the DSM is because it is an issue that still causes, like you said, a lot of anxiety and depression, but not because it's an illness, because it's quite frankly not culturally accepted.
True.
And so it's so difficult for people to get the services they need or to even understand how to talk about this issue. And therefore that causes a lot of distress, which mm-hmm. kind of is the next myth, right? Well, if there's so much distress about this, and if somebody's so anxious and depressed, it must mean that they shouldn't be the, you know, transgender. It should mean that they mm-hmm. should just accept the gender they're in.
Right.
And that's kind of missing the point, right?
Well, and if you go back even to when we were doing Axis 5 diagnoses, you know, the Axis 4 piece, which is, you know, what are the sociocultural issues that might be contributing to the current struggles that someone is having? And when you look at perhaps legal issues being associated with gender dysphoria, when you look at familial conflict, even housing, problems with the law, all of those general things that we sometimes include, or did include, I should say, on that fourth axis, definitely contribute to the overall well-being of a person who suffers from gender dysphoria.
Yeah. Because anyone that's marginalized in any way is going to suffer from, you know, the social factors of these issues. And we do know that transgender individuals have a much higher rate of violence that's, you know, thrown at them, and discrimination, and just, I mean, it's a very tough, you mm-hmm. know, tough lived experience to have to right. go through that, for sure.
Right. For sure. And certainly one of those things that we as allies and educators need to be aware and very conscientious of our privilege when talking about these things, because to be honest, we don't have to deal with this on a constant basis. And in terms of counseling competencies, I think that's something that, in terms of multicultural counseling competencies, this is definitely something that needs to be addressed in greater detail than it has been, knowing that we do have that privilege and being very sensitive to that.
Correct. Right. I can't state enough how, again, this maybe even go back to some of Caitlin Ryan's work, but as whether it's a family culture or a community culture or a religious culture, as we marginalize these people, then the psychosocial effects of that are tremendous and,
yes,
and difficult to overcome. And for us to, you know, like you're saying, in a privileged position, say, well, that's why this is the transgender issue and that's the issue, is really short-sighted and not accurate.
Right.
Okay. I think one of the myths that we kind of already dispelled is this idea that, you know, when males experience arousal by cross-dressing, that's transgender. And again, there's a big spectrum on cross-dressing. Some people do that very privately. And I don't think it's as much an issue for women because we can get away with wearing men's clothing.
Absolutely.
Quite frankly.
Absolutely,
I mean,
yes.
I think that maybe some women, where they take it to a level that people start getting uncomfortable, is, you know, wearing facial hair or maybe a tie, you know, like a suit and tie type of thing. But it's, as women, we have a much wider, I guess, dress code that we can experiment with.
Agreed.
And men, if they want to do anything that's somewhat on the feminine side, is quite taboo and seen as something that's really not socially acceptable. Although it's interesting because we don't come from that, right? I mean, we come from men with large wigs and quite a bunch of, you know,
yes,
kind of interesting attire not so long ago. But
yes. Well, and you think about it, like, Parliament in the UK, they still wear wigs and dresses.
Yes, that's right.
No, that's offense right to my friends from the UK.
Yeah, no, that's right. So this idea that cross, I mean, there, I know men that wear, you know, women's underwear under their clothing. Again, it's not a public affair at all. It's very private. I know straight couples where they incorporate some of that into their sexual play even, or sexual fantasy. But then there's also the other spectrum where, you know, the drag queens, like you mentioned, and, you know, it's very public and almost a performance type of funness about it. And again, those people might be straight, they might be gay, they might be transgender, they may be cisgender. It really is kind of its own spectrum that, again, one can be curious about and ask questions and not just make assumptions.
Right.
Absolutely. Anything further that you want to say about cross-dressing or...
No, I think you covered it, and you've covered a wide range of similar experiences that I've had working with different folks through the last few years. So I think we're good.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, people often get very curious about what you mentioned earlier, which is surgical intervention. So it's the quote unquote sex change. And what, you know, some people will say, well, that's biologically impossible. I know that there's limits, obviously, to that currently in our medical profession. What can you educate us on as far as both hormone replacement and more severe interventions as far as changes that people undergo to try to be more oriented with their gender?
Sure. Hormone therapy is usually the first place that people go to start their transition to identify, to make their gender expression match their gender identity. And people can see a urologist. There's a fantastic OBGYN here in Utah that I refer to. Some people, unfortunately, and quite dangerously, will order their hormones off or online from different parts of the world and self-medicate, which can have, obviously, its risks, and I strongly discourage that, just because of fear of backlash with a provider or even asking the questions about the transition process. Again, that's kind of the first place that people start. In terms of surgical intervention, I go back in terms of surgical intervention doesn't necessarily mean a reassignment surgery. Surgical intervention could be having your Adam's apple shaved, having a brow lift, having cheek implants, having a mastectomy and having breasts removed, or having breast augmentation. To me, all of those constitute surgical intervention to have gender expression match gender identity. And to be honest, my experience is that very few individuals, number one, can afford to do a lot of surgical intervention, and number two, even fewer can afford reassignment surgery. And that's a really tricky venture in and of itself, because there are very few physicians in the world that do good work and really are compassionate and concerned about their patients. There's a doctor, and I would encourage anyone to research her, check her out and her experience. Her name is Dr. Marcy Bauer. She's in the Bay Area in San Francisco. And she herself is a trans woman and phenomenal. I had the opportunity of meeting her a few years ago. One of the most kind, gentle individuals I've ever met. And her philanthropic work in terms of female genital mutilation and other reconstructive surgeries. Again, she's world renowned and an amazing person. So in terms of surgical intervention or even modification, you know, some trans women may do electrolysis to remove the excess body hair. Now, I don't consider that a surgical intervention, but there are a lot of physical, I guess, interventions, aesthetic, if you will, interventions that people may undergo. So that's kind of a really 40-foot description of some of that.
Sure. Yeah. And I agree about the cost constraints for many, and also I think just healthcare constraints for many. You know, I think we're privileged, obviously, in this country to have healthcare, you know, versus other countries that, you know, it's just basic healthcare is also out of reach, you know, much less something more specific like this. Sure. Again, just going back to language as you're talking, I'm just trying to remember language that people may not be familiar with that we are. So when you say trans woman and trans man, that refers to a man, born biologically male, gender identifies as woman, and has come out as such and wants to be addressed as such. So, for example, Caitlyn Jenner would be a trans woman.
Right. Correct.
And that's been some interesting discussion too around orientation with, you know, with Caitlyn, because, you know, well, then is she a lesbian because she's, you know, she reports being attracted to these wives of hers, you know, right, and things of that nature. So again, orientation and trans is different. And so, keeping that in mind. And then as far as my understanding as well with surgical intervention is that it's easier for trans woman surgery than it is for trans man. Is that correct?
Yes. With my trans male patients, just because there has not been very good success at all with gender reassignment for trans men, I strongly discourage it. And again, it's a very personal matter. I have to say that one thing that you should probably never, ever, ever do, and a lot of people think that it's just commonplace to ask someone about their genitalia. And I have never in my life had someone come up and ask me questions about my genitalia. And so it's one of those things that you're like, why would you even think that it's okay to ask a trans person about their genitalia? Just as a matter of fact, like, would you like some coffee? And oh, by the way, do you still have your penis or vagina? Right. You know? So I think that's one thing that you've got to be very, very sensitive to. And again, I just, from the little success or the poor success rate for trans men, I tell people, you know, don't, I mean, make the decision clearly that's best for you, but this could be one that may cause greater physical damage, require further intervention down the road, and just to take it, you know, very, very seriously. So.
Right. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about children. That seems to be a concern for many people. So, in other words, when, you know, kids are little, some maybe gender confusion, if we want to call it, or not even confusion, but, you know, little girls saying, I want to be a boy, or vice versa, or want to play with, you know, toys that are traditionally seen as male or female or feminine or masculine.
Right.
And so therefore, a lot of people will say, well, it's just something that people will grow out of. And again, these decisions shouldn't be made for children so young, when it's mm-hmm. more than probable that it's just a normal part of developmental life cycle. And, you know, they'll get used to or identify with their gender as they get older. Any thoughts
right.
on that?
Children and their development in terms of gender identity. I think that you're right. Like, at a certain age, just in even normal, quote-unquote, human development, there is no differentiation in gender. I mean, even physiologically, male and female bodies look the same until late adolescence and people start puberty, and then curves start forming or not, as the case may be. So I tell this funny story in terms of even just... what's the word I'm looking for? Gender identity and maybe even gender understanding. My oldest daughter was about 3 years old, and I had a nephew over here, and he was maybe anywhere from 15 to 18 months old, and I was changing his diaper, and she kind of gets up on the changing table a little bit, and she says, Mom, is that his vagina? And I said, no, sweetheart, boys have a penis and girls have a vagina. I have a vagina, right, Mom? I said, yes, girls have a vagina. And she said, and that's his penis? And I said, yes, that's his penis. And then she was quiet for a minute and she goes, that's sure a funny looking vagina. And so even at that young age, there's still confusion about the differences in genitalia. And I don't see that there's anything wrong with, you know, a girl dressing up in a football jersey or at younger ages, or at any age for that matter, if a boy wants to play with Barbies. There's really, I would say, no concern, and that's just natural human development and child development. And again, I think when you start to see the differences is when there is a bit more cognitive understanding and a little more personal awareness of who they are. And the children that just adamantly will not wear a dress, the children who want to go to church in a dress, who are male, and they start to make it really very known that clearly there's a different identity than maybe their sex says on their birth certificate. So,
right.
Again, I think that there's part of normal childhood development. I mean, I'm sure you have the same thing. Parents come in and says, my teenager is out of control and they're doing this and this and this. And you basically just say, well, hate to tell you, Mom and Dad, but that's just kind of normal teenage development.
Right.
So, yeah. And I don't want to be an alarmist, and I don't want to minimize, again, the experiences. But to some degree, it's one of those things that you kind of do just have to wait and see how your child develops, and try as hard as you can and be as open as you can and not stifle any of that expression.
Right.
And see where it goes.
Yeah. It's interesting. I had some clients who were, you know, they had I think 7-year-old son, and, you know, he had been talking about, you know, these kinds of issues fairly early. I mean, I'd say 4 or 5, you know, where he was really upset that he wasn't a girl and wanted to wear girl clothes and things of that nature. And what really started alarming them to shift to be more serious about supporting him was the level of depression that mm-hmm. was starting to form in this kid.
Yes.
And that as soon as he was given permission to start wearing dresses and, you know, girly clothes, you know, frou-frou things that he really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. They said it was dramatic, the change that they saw in his just overall personality and ability. And you know, they're members of the church, and so this was very difficult for them. You know, sure. They had to talk to the primary presidency, for example, and prepare mm-hmm. them that, you know, our son is going to be coming to church and address. And mm-hmm. And then they would, you know, had to talk to their elementary school. And now, you know, several years later, the boy is really identifying as a girl and is completely dressing as a girl, and they've, you know, she now has picked a girl name, and you know, obviously there's been no hormone or surgical issues because she's, I think, nine or ten, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. but she's presenting as a girl and just has flourished and bloomed, and just, you know, they can't believe yeah. how different it was, again, from that mental health perspective of what right. they saw their child able to, once, you know, she felt like she could really be who she was, how comfortable that was for her.
Yeah.
But yeah. again, the main issue wasn't the child. The main issue was, you know, the parents having to adjust to that, the church community having to adjust to that, right? The school community. And they were lucky that they lived in a very supportive environment on all fronts, you know, of that. And that doesn't always happen, you know?
Right.
And so there, and it's interesting too that even the girls' peers have been very accepting. Like, once they just kind of like, well, this is what's going to be, you know, because again, mm-hmm. they were so young. Mm-hmm. So the mm-hmm. 7-year-old, 8-year-old boys were like, why are you wearing a dress? Because I want to, and I want to be called, you know, this girl name now. Okay, well, okay. You know, they just all right. kind of went on about their business.
Right.
And it wasn't that big of a deal. Whereas all the adults and the family system, and, you know, it's very traumatic. And, you know, in a sense, you know, I remember them saying, we're losing our son, you know, we're having to grieve our son, and we're having to, you know, accept and invite this new daughter into our home. And
right.
so there's definitely, I don't want to minimize and just say, oh, just be supportive. It's no big deal. I think it's a tremendous deal. I think in our current culture, this is a very difficult thing to know how to maneuver and navigate well. And we often make mistakes along the way.
But yes.
There's definitely, I think, good ways to approach it. And they, you know, they obviously sought out therapy services and, you know, for everybody involved. Well, the last thing I'd like to address a little bit is, I think that when people are going through the transition phase and have transitioned into their gender identity, oftentimes, I mean, obviously, I just gave an example of a young child who did very well, but oftentimes people don't do immediately well after a transition. They can be hit by a lot of emotional aspects, right, of that transition, and that oftentimes can be seen by outsiders as, see, they're not doing well. You know, here they've transitioned and they shouldn't have, right, or something along those lines.
Right.
And I think it's just important to normalize how difficult of a process it is. And I think also there's some privilege issues as well, like men transitioning into women all of a sudden notice how women are treated differently
yes.
than men, right? Or yes. or vice versa, and knowing how to manage that or how to handle a life experience that, and having people treat you in a certain way that you've never been treated before is right. is difficult. It's right. a difficult transition, and with any transition or adjustment can come, you know, mental health symptoms, obviously.
Yeah, it's usually brought up in my sessions in a kind of joking way with my trans women patients. It's excuse me, one of those things is like, are you really sure you want to transition to a glass ceiling and lower wages and sexual harassment? and like I said, it's usually in jest, but you're absolutely right. There's a definite transition. That, you know, you've completely changed your identity and who you once were. And I think that also bears worth mentioning too, is that there are some trans people who will perhaps mourn the loss of their experiences, which they still get to keep with them for sure. But so certainly folks with children, when they transition, they run the risk of losing those relationships with their children, and that is certainly a very high cost for living an authentic life. So
right.
this is not a simple issue. This is not not something to be taken lightly at all.
Yeah, I mean, we're just touching the surface as far as potential experiences, right? If you're transitioning when you're married, or you're transitioning as an adult parent, or you're transitioning as, you know, an adolescent. I mean, there's just so many different factors to consider depending on where a person is and the family system they're in, et cetera. I think the last thing I want to say before I just hand over the floor to you as far as anything else you want to make sure we cover, but I think that I want to just caution members of our church. I know that there's a lot right now that we, you know, the church is saying, you know, you need to stand up for our beliefs and, you know, with this whole marriage equality transition that we're going through right now in our country, I think there's a sense that, you know, doctrine doesn't change, we can be tolerant, et cetera, et cetera. But here's my concern, is that there are many organizations that will co-opt religious people or their teachings or things like that. There's a lot of organizations out there. There's a lot of different therapists or community type organizations that are not church sanctioned that I think can oftentimes, even though it feels good because it's kind of like on that side of things, can give some really bad information and can make the situation worse. I know that there's several, you know, conferences and things of that nature that are currently happening that I'm very concerned about that will further kind of these myths and misconceptions that we're talking about today, and that will also higher the risk of suicide or negative effects for those who are living these situations, or families and friends that want to be supportive and don't know how, and yet they're getting bad information from a lot of sources that, you know, are not church sanctioned, may seem like they're kind of in line with the church, and yet are giving really bad information. Anything you want to say about that?
I would say I am agreeing with what you're saying. I think, unfortunately, that fear drives a lot of the sensationalized media, and that fear then promotes the misinformation. And if you can tap into someone's fear and create some sort of questioning about their safety and their way of life and their living, I mean, you're certainly going to get a reaction out of people. And that's what worries me about giving misinformation and appealing to people's value-based systems and their moral and ethical beliefs, that if you can instill some fear based on those moral and ethical beliefs, you can get a long way, and then people kind of shut down to seeking accurate information. So I guess I would just say to the community at large, there's two sides to every coin, and certainly this is one of the coins that we need to look at quite carefully and understand that even if it is written by someone who is highly respected in a medical profession, in the mental health profession, they certainly have their biases, judgments, and opinions about certain things. And you have to consider the other side as well. I feel it's the same as if there's an article or a study published about how fantastic a particular new psychotropic medication is, and then you get to the end of the article and you see that it's funded and was supported by Pfizer or whomever was making the drug. So you obviously get the slant as to why that data was interpreted the way it was. And I would just encourage people to look for the sources, look for the source material and the primary, who's behind the information and what their motive might be.
Yeah, the agendas and the biases. And obviously we fit into that as well. I mean, you're welcome to look us up and see what we're about. But I think that there's just a lot of potential for, especially I think, people who are trying to do what's right and be, you know, good Mormons and stand up for what's right, there's just a lot of potential for people to take advantage of that. And even those people who are coming up with those programs, I think, are part of that. I'm not saying that they're maliciously doing that. I'm just saying that they're also trying to make it fit with their belief system. But mm-hmm. oftentimes that can just lead to, I think, unethical practice and misinformation.
Sure. Yeah. I think this just goes back to the idea of get curious rather than making those knee-jerk and snap judgments and snap decisions is my recommendation to, again, other therapists and the community at large. Get curious.
Right. Yeah, I like that. Well, is there anything that I'm leaving out that you wanted to make sure we covered today, or anything that you want to close out our thoughts with today?
Wow, we've really been all over the spectrum of this for sure. And I feel like we could sit here all day and talk about trans issues. And I think the thing that I would just part with is just say, get the information out there. And for counselors, based on, you know, my little straw poll in my office, if you haven't had experience working with trans patients and there's someone that you would like to, and it's a population that you would like to work with or have been asked to, get the education that you need and get some training in terms of the competencies so that there is a comfort level in for you and for those who may come in and meet you in your office. So again, I think it's just educate yourselves and be an ally and educate others when there are myths and mysteries and inaccurate information being perpetuated.
Yes, I agree. And I would encourage, a lot of times it's not the professionals that get these issues first, but it's ecclesiastical leaders. You know, where a family comes in and talks to a bishop or a stake president or a Relief Society president about some of these issues. And again, just, I would really encourage people in ecclesiastic leadership roles to really be very careful and mindful about the types of directions you send people in. Understanding that especially with these types of issues, there's a really high risk of suicide, and so to really take that seriously.
Yeah.
And that it's okay to make room for people, even if it makes us a little bit uncomfortable, or even if we're unsure how that fits with current doctrinal understandings, that it's more important to make the space that a family or an individual might need than to always be right or figure everything out, you know, according to our current, I guess, Bishop's Handbook, in a sense,
yeah.
Right, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And certainly, you know, we didn't talk about the scary statistics at all, and again, I would encourage people to educate themselves, but in the trans community, 41% of trans individuals attempt suicide, and that is 4 times higher than general population national average. And that, to me, is reason enough alone to educate our community and educate ourselves as therapists and ecclesiastical leaders, etc., to find out how we can prevent these attempts. And unfortunately, with a higher percentage of attempts, there's going to be a higher number of suicidality and people who suicide. So, yeah.
Right. And that this is a particularly... I think a particularly vulnerable time when there's so much noise in the media around these issues.
Right.
And when the church is coming out with statements and things of that nature that I know are well-intended as far as taking a stance, and yet there might be people in your congregations listening to these statements that's the trigger to end their life that day.
Mm-hmm.
And so to just be very cautious as far as how those messages are delivered and be very mindful that these issues, you know, for the majority of the members will be just an issue of where does our church stand, but that for a smaller amount, it's a reality of how they think they can live their life. And that's very, it just takes it to a whole nother level.
It does.
And like you said, everybody knows somebody from Boston, so it affects all of us, you know, whether we're family members or friends or congregational members that, you know, sit next to somebody who might be dealing with something like this. So again, in Relief Society and Sunday School and Elders Quorum, be mindful of your comments. You know, don't assume that there's not a transgender person in your congregation or sitting right next to you. These things are often held very secret. And I think sometimes I'm kind of appalled at the things we say in front of each other, that not really knowing each other's situations.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, and again, this might be going a little too far off, but just the uniformity that happens within the church, that if you're wearing a dress and sit in Relief Society, then you identify and are a woman. And if you wear a suit and tie and go to Elders Quorum and High Priest, that you are male. And so your insight into saying, hey, be mindful of what you say, because you don't know the struggle the person sitting next to you is having or could be going through right now.
Right.
And I think that's important to be sensitive, so I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah. I think with current numbers, there's probably 2 to 5 families in each ward that are dealing with some issue around LGBTQ issues.
Agreed.
And I think we oftentimes forget that.
Yes. Yes. Thanks for having me here, and I will just apologize for my little sidekick commentator the last little while. She
sounds lovely. Well, that's a good thing. Expression.
I know. Yes.
Thank you so much for your time. I look forward to seeing you next month and hearing your presentation. And I just can't thank you enough for talking on such a sensitive issue in such a fabulous and just informed way. So thank you for sharing of your knowledge with us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Over last tempestuous sea, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Unknown ways before me roll. Hiding rock and treacherous shore, chart and compass came from thee. Jesus, Savior, pilot me.
As a mother stills her child,
boisterous way,
obey thy will,
when thou sayest
to them, be still,
wondrous sovereign of the sea, Jesus, Savior. when at last I near the shore and the fearful breakers roar, may I hear. Fear not, I will pilot thee. Twixt me and the peaceful rest. Then while leaning on my breast, may I hear. Fear not.